Hello, and welcome to the second lecture on the Race, Class, Gender book. Today I will be talking about intersectionality, which is what the introduction to the book deals with. Intersectionality began as a perspective in what is known as legal theory, or the study of law. And the person who formulated it was named Kimberly Crenshaw. Kimberly Crenshaw is a brilliant person, and if we were having this class face-to-face, I would show you a video of Kimberly Crenshaw giving a brilliant presentation on intersectionality. Subsequently, Patricia Hill Collins, a sociologist, adopted intersectionality and brought it into sociology. And that is the beginning of the impact of intersectionality upon sociology, especially the sociology of social problems, which of course is what this course is about. The basic idea behind intersectionality is that we can conceive of the world or of a particular society as a map, like a road map. If you think of a map as having different intersections on it, for example, here where I live in Olathe, there is a street called Ridgeview, and I try as much as possible to avoid Ridgeview, especially the part of Ridgeview that is south of Santa Fe. If you've ever been in that area, you know that there are two roundabouts, or as we call them in New York City, traffic circles, on Ridgeview, where several different lines of traffic are entering in. And there are yield signs, but because most people are not familiar with traffic circles in this part of the country, or for that matter in most parts of the country, including the New York City area where I'm from, people often make a lot of mistakes. So when I am going down Ridgeview, on the rare cases I do, I generally assume, even if I do not have a yield sign, that I do. Because I think it's a pretty good bet that somebody is going to make a mistake and not yield and go right through the traffic circle or the roundabout. On the other hand, you have four-way stops. There are four-way stops all over the country, and most people are familiar with four-way stops. You know that whoever gets to the stop sign first is the one who goes first. And generally speaking, most people follow that. Why? Because four-way stops are familiar. It's habitual. You know what to do when you confront a four-way stop. So, although four-way stops and roundabouts or traffic circles serve a similar function, the results of each of them are not the same. Roundabouts are considerably more complex than four-way stops. That is because you have more intersections meeting at the point of a roundabout than you do at a four-way stop. The more intersections that you have, the more difficult, problematic, and hazardous, or potentially hazardous, driving can become. Similarly, if we look at, say, American society, we can see all these different intersections which exist in American society. We have an intersection of race, of class, of gender, of disability, of ethnicity, of nationality, and so on. And at these different intersections, there are people who possess varying amounts of power. So, when you confront another person at a particular intersection, and let's say you are an upper class person, and you are confronting a lower class person, then you by definition have more power than the other person. You have the power to determine, or at least to some extent manipulate, the way in which events take place. As a result, because of that extra power that you have, that gives you an ability to navigate the intersection more clearly, more deliberately, and more carefully than the other person. The more the intersections, the more difficult things become. Let's, for example, look at the intersection of policing in the United States. I might have mentioned the story, but it doesn't hurt to mention it again. Back in the early 1970s, when I was spending a summer in South Carolina, I used to spend a lot of summers in South Carolina. I knew this guy named Jack. He was an African-American guy, really, really, really nice person. Jack and I got along extraordinarily well. I would very commonly go over to Jack's place, and we would have these long conversations. Now, I was a kid. Pardon me while I take some water. I would go over to Jack's place, and Jack would tell me stories. Now, I really liked Jack. The reason I liked him is because he was a very straightforward person. Jack would say whatever was on my mind. I was about maybe 14, 15 years old. Jack was probably in his 50s, but, you know, Jack didn't talk down to me. Now, he didn't talk up to me either, but he talked to me as a human being. And I liked him for that reason, because he was just a good person, a good all-around person, very likable individual. His wife I didn't know that well, because she was on the quiet side, and she really didn't say that much, but Jack I knew very well. One day, I went by to see Jack, knocked on the door. I noticed that there was a wreath hanging from the door. And so when Hattie, Jack's wife, opened the door, I made what was in retrospect a very inappropriate comment, but innocent. I wasn't trying to be disrespectful, but it certainly was inappropriate. And I said, Hattie, it's a bit early to be celebrating Christmas. I was making a joke. Hattie said back to me, Mark, Jack got shot today. I said, Hattie, I am deeply sorry. I am deeply sorry. I'll see you later. Well, I never saw Hattie again. Went by in a couple of weeks, felt it was appropriate to wait that amount of time. The house was abandoned. Certainly didn't blame Hattie for leaving after what happened. Here's what happened. Jack was a very vocal person. He always said exactly what was on his mind. Always. In the early or mid-1970s, in South Carolina, that was a very dangerous way for an African American to behave. It's part of why I liked him so much, but it was very dangerous. For example, I remember walking down a street on South Carolina, and an old black man, called me sir. I was 14 or 15 years old. I was in shock. So I liked Jack because of his openness, his fearlessness, his integrity. But again, that was a dangerous way to be at that time. Jack loved basketball. He was at a high school basketball game, got there early, got a front row in the bleachers. Before the game started, a deputy sheriff came up to him and said, "Jack," everyone knew who Jack was, "Jack, I want your seat." And Jack said, "No, I got here first. Find your own seat." The deputy repeated again, "Jack, I want your seat." Again, Jack refused. At that point, the deputy sheriff pulled out his revolver, shot Jack point blank in the head. Jack was immediately dead. The deputy sheriff was arrested, as was procedure. He was held in county jail overnight, and he was released the following morning. The district attorney decided not to press any charges. Pardon me again, taking another drink of water. I was amazed. No charges? I was just speechless about that. This was in the newspaper. Now, at that time, I did not know how widespread this problem was. The deputy sheriff was back on the force the next day as well. More recently, this movement called Black Lives Matter started. It originated as a Twitter hashtag, started by three African American women whose husbands were killed by police. Later became a website. There is no Black Lives Matter organization. You can't join Black Lives Matter. It's a movement. It's a website. Anybody can say that they're Black Lives Matter who wants. I have several Black Lives Matter t-shirts and sweatshirts and a Black Lives Matter armband. Pardon me. And so I identify myself with Black Lives Matter, even though I'm not African American. I very closely relate to it because I was involved in the civil rights movement back in the late 1960s when I was in middle school. So now we know how widespread the problem is. Now we know that police shootings of unarmed black women and men are very widespread and take place all the time. Now, we also know that most law enforcement officers who engage in those shootings are never arrested, and those who are arrested are almost never convicted. So, we have been dealing with this phenomenon of lynchings of African Americans by police and others. Since the first slave ships arrived on American shores, whether by police have done it, sheriffs have done it, average people in what eventually became known as the Ku Klux Klan have done it, it's a very, very widespread problem. And that's an example of an intersection. It's an intersection of policing. The police officer, by definition, has more power because she or he is carrying a gun. And also the law, to some extent, is behind the police officer. And the police officer knows that even if he or she commits an act of murder, that most likely he or she will not be punished for it. The other person, whoever it is, especially a person who is black or brown, knows that that person has almost no power in that encounter. That is an example of how intersectionality works. That is intersectionality. So you take that same basic idea and you apply it across the board. Give you another example. This is just a figurative or hypothetical example. Let's say that you have a woman who is being harassed by her boss at her company, sexually harassed. Her boss comes to her and asks for sexual favors, and he says, in return, you can work here and eventually get a promotion. Otherwise, I will have to let you go. Now, she needs that job. That's an example of an intersection of sexism in this country. The male boss has a tremendous amount of power. The woman working there has almost no power. Then, let's say that same woman goes home. Let's say she lives in a relatively affluent neighborhood. Her husband makes a lot more money than she does. And they find out that there are plans to build a low-income housing project a few blocks away from where they live. When she finds this out, she joins with other people in the neighborhood to fight against the construction of this lower-income housing project. So, in that case, we also see an intersection. It is an intersection of racism. And in this case, the woman is the oppressor. And the African Americans and others, maybe Latinos, maybe even some white people who are planning on moving into this place, they are the oppressed. That is the beauty of intersectionality, because what it does is it eliminates the kind of simplistic idea that we live in a society with oppressors and oppressed. That's clearly not true. It's much more complex than that. A single individual can be an oppressor in one intersection and oppressed in another intersection. Now, Patricia Hill Collins talks about the concept of reconstructing knowledge. What she means by that is that as we gain an understanding of intersectionality, our awareness of the situation of oppression in American society will improve. And hopefully, if our eyes are open and our hearts are open, then we may change ourselves. We may be motivated to change our own consciousness, how we look at these kinds of situations. Collins also talks about, this is also in the introduction, the matrix of domination. Matrix of domination is basically another term for intersectionality. It's kind of Collins' own model or concept of intersectionality. By matrix, she means some kind of a grid. Of course, several years ago, there were a series of movies called the Matrix movies, science fiction movies. Collins came up with the notion of the matrix of domination long before those Matrix movies were produced. So she was not influenced by that. So I think she means some kind of a grid or a map. Whatever you call it, whether you call it intersectionality, which is the most common term, whether you call it a matrix of domination, which is one of Collins' terms, although she also uses the term intersectionality, it's the same basic phenomenon. It is the way oppression works, not only in this country, but throughout the world. Next week, we will start with the first article as listed toward the bottom of the blog page. Have a good one.